Tonight on Arena, Carey Crowley and Jim Nolan on Jim's new play about the secrets of a Waterford family, and Palestinian-British filmmaker Farah Nabulsi on her debut feature, The Teacher. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Castel Gandolfo is a new play set in the backyard of a decaying terraced house in Waterford's inner city. The story unfolds over 2 days as the family of Stephen Callaghan, a dying man, see the frail threads that bind them come undone. His daughter Rose is on the brink of losing her job. His son Tony is struggling to restore a vintage car. His granddaughter Stella is abandoning her law degree for a job in a local chipper. And adding to the chaos, Stephen's ex-wife Dolly is returning and bringing old secrets to light, premiering at Garter Lane Arts Centre in Waterford. Jim Nolan is the writer of the play, and it also stars Waterford native Carey Crowley, highly lauded, of course, for her role in the Oscar-nominated and Colin Cunin, familiar to many from the small screen as Jackie in Fair City. Delighted to be joined by both Carey and Jim from Waterford City on this Monday evening. And I guess the Waterford City part of it is quite interesting for both of you, Carey. You're home.
I'm home. And I'm loving it. And it's just, there's something gorgeous about being in a place where you know half the town anyway. And as you walk around, it's just so full of conversations and memories and really positive kind of support from people. Oh, we'll be in, we'll be coming, we're all coming. And hopefully they will all come because it's a really, really interesting piece. And I think, and I know somebody else who came in to look at it the other day, feels the same. I think it's Jim's finest work. I think it is wonderful. I just think it's so well written. And you go through all the emotions. You laugh, and then you're kind of shocked into a stupor. And yet there are moments of hope and moments of despair, and they both seem to work in this piece.
I guess like many a family story, Jim, there's great love, there's great enmity, there are secrets that are just some people want to deal with now, this very minute, and other people are asking, elephant? What elephant in what room?
Absolutely. All the colours of the rainbow. How are you doing, Sean?
Not too bad, Jim.
It's certainly, it's a family of many colours. And like Carey said, I should really leave both of you at it, actually, because you seem to be both great ambassadors of the piece without me saying a word. It's a dark old piece in places, but it's like, as you said, any family story, there are darkness and there's light there. It started perversely with a house. The house was the first character in it. The play is called Castel Gandolfo. I was sorry I didn't set it in the Vatican or in the Pope's summer residence and write a frothy little sex comedy or something. But it's the name of the house, and Carey's character is was born in New York and of a Waterford father and an Italian mother. She was quite the exotic. But following the death of her mother, her father shanghaied her back to Waterford to live with her maiden aunts, and that was the beginning of a long story that kind of ended in she married, had a couple of children, lived in the house, got to own the house by sort of nefarious means, and eventually her marriage to a local man, a cobbler, the Stephen Callaghan that you referred to, ends in tears some 15 years after it started. And the kind of the skeletons come of that sort of rupture or fracture in the family are buried for many years. But they, like many other houses, the chickens come home to roost and the skeletons come out of the closet eventually.
Yeah, they have to be dealt with. And it's one of the things that struck me, Carey, about the character of Dolly herself. You know, you'd be forgiven for getting a little bit annoyed with her, some of her attitudes early on in the play. She's quite dismissive of the children, some of them that she kind of almost barely talks to, in fact. But as the play unfolds, and I presume this was the attraction or part of the attraction in it for you, as the play unfolds, you realise she has her reasons perhaps for being the way she is.
Yes. And I also think it's very easy to look. You could pick the people in the play that you think are the most damaged or the most broken. But I, not just because I'm playing her, but I look at Dolly and I think, Christ, what a life she has had to live as well. Like, there was all the fracture in her earlier life. So you could be forgiven for just saying, God, what a despot. She comes home and she decides she's going to do this, this, this and this. But she's coming from a place of hurt. And she has also inflicted hurt. So she's not a saint, but she's a vulnerable person in her own way. They all are. But they're also survivors. And Dolly's, by God, she's a survivor, you know?
She is that. And even as Jim was describing her there, Carrie, it struck me, you know, the fact that she has all of those kind of mixed up identities, that the Italian mother, the Irish father, then being shipped off to America. And she has this kind of Irish-American accent when we meet her first. And you're not quite sure who this woman actually is. How much of the feel of Waterford do you think, Carrie, is in the play and in the character of Dolly?
I don't think Dolly wears much of Waterford on her sleeve. I think the boys do. Dolly kind of doesn't, because even when she came to Waterford, she was 15. Hmm. She came back from America. All her life had been spent in America. So she's a New Yorker. She's coming here. And by Christ, it's probably the thing that most makes her stand out. So it's almost like a badge of honor. She's not going to change.
Yeah.
So she holds on to it, dearly to it.
She's an outsider in the family, and she certainly is an outsider in the family as it has progressed. There are three children in their 40s and thereabouts, and there's a grandchild involved in all of this as well. But for you, Jim, then, perhaps Carrie quite rightly pointing out that Dolly perhaps doesn't wear much of Waterford on her sleeve. I think certainly the family, the brother who's at home fixing up the vintage car, his daughter and his sister Rose, the daughter Stella, they all are wearing their Waterford colours. They'd be wearing the dish colours without any doubt.
I suppose, as a Waterford writer, like for a long number of years, Sean, I was setting plays in fictional towns that were kind of really Waterford in disguise. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, I wrote a play called The Red Iron, which was set on the local bridge. And it was really great to have been back, you know, just speaking the language of Waterford, although, as Carrie has said, her character is Irish-American and very much of that patois. But it's not particularly a Waterford play, but it's a particular joy to have set the play here just as a Waterford writer. But you'd kind of hope, I suppose, in some ways, that the themes, the stuff it's exploring are elemental and kind of belong anywhere. But it's nice to hear the Waterford voice and even to hear the names of the local streets mentioned. So we'll see how it goes down.
It did strike me, and I have to be careful. I know that Waterford is a city, but
yes,
it has the feeling of, you know, in some ways the play has the feeling of any small town in Ireland. Yeah. Any large town in Ireland, any small city in Ireland.
I'm really glad you said that, because like I always, when I lived in the suburbs in Waterford, we were always going into town or coming out from town. And I remember in the early days of Red Kettle, if I was doing an interview like this and I referred to the town, somebody from the local Chamber of Commerce would call you and say, it's a city, Jim, you must refer to it as a city. But where I'm concerned, it's this beautiful town that I was lucky enough to grow up in and work in. And I'm really glad you said you had described it thus.
It has that feel, and certainly within the play, it has that feeling of it, of the small town or the slightly bigger town, because there is a suburbs involved within it. How much work? I mean, obviously, Carrie, I mentioned the wonderful on Colleen Kuhne, and we spoke about that the night of the Oscars themselves. I remember how much very strong emotion and love there was in the room and right around the country for that film that night. And I'll come back to it. But how much, how much have you had a chance to actually work at home in Waterford?
The last time I was working in Waterford was with Ben Barnes as well, who's directing this.
We did
A Taste of Beckett. So it was two Beckett shows. I did Footfalls and Arthur Reardon did Crap's Last Tape, and we did them as an evening, and we did that for a few weeks, and I loved it, and I loved being back home, because it's home, like, you can't deny where you're from. It's deep inside you. So I love having the chance to come here to work. It's fantastic.
Can I say, Sean, what a joy it's been to have Carrie back. She's one of our great local exports. She's like Waterford Crystal or the Blah. And it was great sending her out into the world, but even better to have her back. And I've had the pleasure of walking through the streets with her, you know, in breaks from rehearsal. And like she could be selling ticket as she walks. I'm sorry we haven't a sandwich board plastered to her. And it's just wonderful to have her back. And in fact, I would say, just as someone who used to run Red Kettle here, it was far too long. I did a couple of shows with Carrie back in the early days, and like her career took her elsewhere. But it's really been a joy to have her back in town and to be working with her. I've been very lucky, Sean, to have been part of the team that assembled in that rehearsal room a month ago. And it's been a real joy to make this play. I bring in the words, but the actors make the play and the director, Ben Barnes. And it's just been a real joy to see it coming together. And also
I would echo that. Yeah.
And I'm guessing, Carrie, that from your point of view, obviously the screen work, I suppose, is what goes a long way towards paying the rent. But when you come to doing the theatre work, that's where you can express the true love of acting, even if the money isn't. It certainly, you won't be doing any theatre job for the money involved.
No, it's not about the money at all. But I think I'm at an age now where I don't have to do it for the money. I'm okay. I have a house. So I'm not looking only for money gigs. In fact, I kind of nearly do the flip of that. I have to look at a project and say, I am doing that. And I don't care. If they've no money, I don't care. So a lot of the stuff I do is like very low paying, but it's so worthwhile because your heart sings when you're going to work.
Yeah, well, even as I mentioned on Colin Kuhn, on Colin Kuhn was hardly a multi-million pound budget when it was made either.
Nope.
The film itself, but it has been an astounding success. You've had time maybe now to look at that success, to look at that Oscar nomination, longest running film in the IFI, I think, for a long period of time. What do you put it down to ultimately with the benefit of hindsight?
I think Colm Baird, the director, did an extraordinary job on it. And even like with Jim's script, when I read that script for the first day and I was auditioning for it, and I thought, please, 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 let somebody just see me as right for this part, because I so wanted to play it. The script was stunning. But also Colm allowed things to sit. He wasn't doing the, oh, audiences give up after 3 minutes and you have to move and do something different. He allowed for a very restful film in some ways to emerge. So the story and people just entered into it and they were taken along almost friedrich. There was almost like some kind of spell had been cast on people from all over the world, not just Irish people. And in the beginning, when I saw it at the cast and crew screening, I thought, this is amazing, but you kind of feel it'll be for Irish audiences. And then when you see people in Japan, you see people in America, and they all recognize something in it. I think it's because it's such a tiny little story. Instead of trying to satisfy everybody, Colm did the really wise thing of telling one true story and let people come and feel that story and go on the journey. And it just seems to have worked, and it's still working. I mean, isn't that brilliant? You know yourself. It's like, you know, when you did different plays and different things, you know when something works, and you can't ignore the joy of that, or the, you know, just the magical kind of chemistry of it. Something just really fell into place.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
It certainly, and I think even that title on Colin Kuhn says so much about what you've just said about how Colm Baird went about directing it. But I guess, Jim, I mean, it struck me with on Colin Kuhn, it is a very, as Carrie said, small local story. But, you know, all the big stories are small and local.
Absolutely.
Who was it talked about, the Odyssey or the Iliad being a local? It's nothing but a little local
That's
skirmish.
Right. Mr. Patrick Kavanagh, wasn't it?
How could I forget that it was he that would do so? Of course, a man would have come up with such an intelligent comment.
Monaghan?
Yeah, I know. I have to get it in on every programme. I insist. I have to get at least one mention in. That is what you're doing in Castle Gandolfo. You are taking, I mean, how more local and how smaller can you get than a family? But the emotions aren't small when you go down into that microcosm Jim?
Yeah, I've been lucky to make theatre in this place, in Waterford, most of my adult life. The theatre where this one opens is my second home at Garter Lane. And it is, at the heart of that, is a belief that the local is the universal, and that the stories of any place, of any small place, if they're told properly and told with honesty and integrity, will apply anywhere. I've tried to be faithful to that, and certainly I think this play is not even the play, but the making of it. Hmm. And in that regard, it's great to be able to mention, if I might, that it's produced by the Four Rivers Company, who are based in Wexford but are a theatre company for the Southeast. They did a wonderful production of A Handful of Stars by Billy Roach lately, and did some readings of his work to celebrate his career in the theatre. They've also done new plays by Wexford writers, and this is just the latest string to their bow. So there's especially, I suppose, at a time when the focus, understandably and maybe even properly, is with the Dublin Theatre Festival. We didn't plan to be opening at this time, and we are. But it's nice to be making our own statement. And we certainly believe that what works here, you know, is a story that can be told anywhere.
Yeah. Finally, Carrie, what is next for you? I know obviously this will be the run of this for a while, and if it's successful, there might even be some kind of touring with it, I would hope, if that comes to pass. But what's next down the line for you, or do you know?
I know some things that are coming out. So I had to go back to Dublin and do some voice work on a film we made up in County Antrim early in the year, a thing called Anthus Union, and I think it's going to be a fine film.
And Os Gael Go Rís on that?
It's Os Gael Go Rís, yeah, which is fantastic. And then I've also signed up with a gorgeous woman, Ciarán Cormac. She made the documentary about Deirdre Ní Riafa. And I are going to be on the road making a doc, Os Gael Go Rís, but it's Sáile, so it's about the sea. And I love the sea. So she and I will be kind of exploring different kind of connections to the sea. And anyway, that's the next kind of big project, I suppose. And then whatever else comes in, just...
Yeah. When it arrives on the door, you'll know it.
Sean, could I just mention, I'm terribly sorry and I'll be shot for it, but Gallery Press, Peter Fallon's company, are publishing this play. I only wanted to mention that because, like, he's, as you know, he's a poetry publisher, only publishes a handful of plays, and he's been producing my work, or presenting it rather, since 1992. I've always been very grateful for that, and there's a launch of this book at the Book Centre in Waterford on October 11th, and everybody's welcome, and I'm really sorry for doing the plug there.
You're saved from the firing squad as a result. So
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks very much, Jim, and thanks, Carrie, as well, for being with us. That's Carrie Crowley and Jim Nolan, and the play Castle Gandolfo runs from Friday the 4th of October through until Saturday the 19th at Garter Lane, a theatre in Waterford, and you'll find full details on garterlane.ie. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. I tell you, the entire production room up on their feet, dancing and shouting Mambo as we play that bit of Leonard Bernstein's music. More than 30 years on from his death in 1990, the influence of Bernstein on modern culture is as palpable as it ever was. Famously, he was the first superstar conductor catapulted into the limelight after he famously stepped in to replace Bruno Walter at the New York Philharmonic performance at Carnegie Hall. No notice to speak of, and certainly very little rehearsal. But it's Leonard Bernstein's vast work as a composer of scores that will soon be marked at a special concert Wednesday of next week in in fact, the 9th of October, the RTE Concert Orchestra will perform Leonard Bernstein, A Celebration, under the baton of Martin Yates. I'll be there to compare things myself. We'll hear music from On the Town, scores from other pieces, including Candide, and of course, his most towering work, West Side Story, promises to showcase the scope of Bernstein's remarkable gift in music and song. That is what the concert will do. But I'm delighted to be joined on the programme this evening by the conductor on the evening, Martin Yates, who trained with Bernstein's great friend, the conductor André Previn, and more of that conducting lineage shortly, Martin. But you know, I don't know what it was like where you were listening, but it is practically impossible to sit still while listening to Mambo.
It is just the most extraordinary, vibrant piece, isn't it? I mean, incredible. And you know, the rhythmic propulsion of it all. And, you know, what's extraordinary about it is that it feels like it was written yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not dated at all. I mean, everything that we know dates, and you can kind of work out roughly where these things came from. The greatest scores, you know, even great scores like Chorus Line, they sound like the 1970s. This, you know, is 1957, and yet it sounds fresh as yesterday. Quite extraordinary.
And also what strikes me, and it's there in other aspects of the stuff that we'll be playing and that you'll be conducting on Wednesday week, the rhythmic. You talked about propulsion there, but it seems to me as if it's jumping rhythms, it's changing rhythms. One section is playing in one rhythm, another section is playing in another, but yet they all fit together perfectly.
Yeah, and you know something? It was I watched a program where Bernstein was talking about his early days as a pianist, you know, just trying things out when he was a kid, and there was a piano in the hall outside his parents' apartment. And he started playing things, and he was playing famous tunes, Irving Berlin and all sorts of things, but his left hand was playing these jerky, jumping rhythms. And it must have been with him from a very early age. This, what you're talking about is like two beats against three or three yeah. beats against four. I mean, it, you know, not getting too technical about it, but it's extraordinary because it was a complete part of who he was.
So he was managing to do two beats on his left hand and three beats on his right hand as a kid.
Absolutely. Because he couldn't, all he could do was play the tune with the right hand. He couldn't play anything with the left hand. So he just busked it. And yeah, he ends up busking what he ends up writing. I mean, it is extraordinary.
Well, that's an interesting route, certainly from piano to composer, as you've just described it there, and a conductor as well. But let's listen to Bernstein himself from one of those famous programs, the educational programs he did on the television. Here he is talking about conducting itself.
How can I describe to you the magic of the moment of beginning a piece of music at a concert? There is only one possible fraction of a second that feels exactly right for starting. There is a wait while the orchestra readies itself and collects its powers, while the conductor concentrates all his will and force onto the work in hand, while the audience quiets down and the last cough has died away, there is no slight rustle of a program book, the instruments are poised, and bang!
And bang indeed, Leonard Bernstein then. And it could be bang into Mambo, or it could be bang into the overture to Candide, which you'll also be conducting, Martin Yates, at this at this concert with the RTE Concert Orchestra. But interesting, what you hear there is his mind as a conductor and the excitement that clearly he got from it. How do you think that combination that he has, he's not the only composer and conductor in the world in history, but how important was it in how he made and composed and then performed his music?
Oh, I think it was absolutely crucial. I mean, just hearing him talking then, you know, he says a couple of things about the will and the force. I mean, his force of will is going to impose on the music what he wants. And also it's his innate sense of theatricality, you know, that he's waiting for that moment when the last program has rustled, the last person has coughed, and then bang, he goes for it. It's pure theatre. And everything he did was theatrical. I mean, I know he had a reputation for jumping around on the rostrum, but I genuinely believe that he did that naturally. I don't think he ever imposed it. It just felt so right for him. And I think that the same thing is about his music, about his conducting. Everything feels completely right. It's all in the right place. It's all incredibly theatrical and driven.
Let's have a listen, because one of the great joys of the concert on Wednesday week will be the fact that we have several really fine vocalists with us on the evening, performing various songs from the various musicals along the way. I wanted to listen to this just for the lyrics as much as anything else. 100 Easy Ways from Wonderful Time.
Yeah.
The first way to lose a man. You've met a charming fellow and you're out for a spin. The motor fails and he just wears a helpless grin. Don't bat your eyes and say, what a romantic spot we're in. Just leap out, crawl into the car, say it's the gasket and fix it in 2 seconds flat with a bobby pin. That's a good way to lose a man. He takes you to a baseball game, you sit knee to knee. He says the next man up at bat will bunt, you'll see. Don't say, oh, what's a bunt? This game's too hard for little me. Just say, bunt, are you nuts? With one out, two men on base and a left-handed batter coming up, he'll walk right into a triple play, the same as in the fifth game of the World Series in 1923. That's a sure way to lose a man. A sure,
100 easy ways. A 100 ways to leave your lover, but 100 easy ways to lose him along the way as well. Wonderful, wonderful time. That is from the Bernstein musical. And Martin Yates, who will be conducting the RTÉ Concert Orchestra and performances of lots of Bernstein music, including Wonderful Time, is with me on the programme this evening. I wanted to listen to that as much as anything, Martin, because I wanted to ask you a little bit about the lyricists that he had worked with along the way. Because it struck me listening to that, you can hear how Gershwin had influenced, even in his orchestration in that particular piece from Wonderful Time. But also, obviously, there was no Ira Bernstein, like there was an Ira Gershwin. Yeah. Where did the lyrics come from for that one in particular? Do you know?
Yeah, well, that's Compton and Green. They were a famous double act that they'd done Variety and all sorts of things together, you know, doing other people's material and eventually started writing lyrics. And there was something about their lyrics which harped back to, as you're alluding to, the lyrics of Ira Gershwin and people from that era. And yet there was a sardonic sort of bite to it. So, you know, that, I mean, you know, this is, you know, it could be almost, you know, well, you can easily lose your man if you're not careful. But what they're saying is, this is how you get rid of him.
Yes. I mean,
it's much more biting and sardonic and New York, you know, that it's not LA or anything, and it's absolutely biting New York. And he worked with them on two musicals, didn't he? Because he did On the Town with them as well.
Yes,
but of course. You know, he ended up with Stephen Sondheim on West Side Story. I mean, you know, these are great people, and 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue with Alan J. Lerner.
He had the cream of the crop, but of course he was giving them great music for their lyrics, or they were giving him great lyrics for his music, whichever way the particular relationship came. You mentioned actually 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Where does that come in his body of work?
Oh, it's his last musical, so it's 1976. It was Alan J. Lerner lyrics, and who also wrote the book, in fact, Alan J. Lerner, who'd written My Fair Lady, you know, so he was a, you know, no slouch. It was actually Bernstein's only flop, and he was never tempted to write a musical again. I think he did seven performances and some previews, but, you know, it's late on, and it's a shame, because actually, I mean, I was talking to your researcher earlier on, I looked at the vocal score of that the other day, the whole thing, and it's a really remarkable piece. I suspect it was just ahead of its time and probably got bogged down in the politics of putting on a show, you know, as so many things can. But it's a great, great piece, and, you know, written about the White House, that is 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and the presidents that have been there from 1800 to 1900. I mean, quite extraordinary.
I want to listen to a little bit of Take Care of This House, because it shows us maybe a different side, the kind of lyrical melody that Bernstein was capable of, as much as, you know, as the fireworks of Mambo or the clever pitter-pat of the piece we were just listening to from 100 Easy Ways from Wonderful Town. This is a different style altogether.
This house that is struggling to be a beacon of light, shining all through the night, so bright that the whole world could see. But now there's a chill in the room. Windows are starting to leak. Floorboards are starting to creak. And hope, hope may arrive. The house will survive. If only these walls could speak.
And there we go. Take Care of This House from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The final musical, as Martin Yates has been telling me, of Leonard Bernstein. Wonderful singing there from Barbra Streisand. That's from her album Walls in 2018. And how suitable that we should have Barbra Streisand singing on the day when we'll be remembering Kris Kristofferson shortly on the programme as well. But that does show Martin Bernstein's facility. It's easy to think of him as, you know, the big flashy bang, as he says himself, style of conductor and style of composer. But there is a very delicate side to his melodic writing as well.
Incredibly delicate. And what's brilliant about it is right from the beginning, that little da 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 dee da, it draws you in. You want to know what is this about? I mean, he's fantastic at allowing the words to speak and giving it exactly the right timbre so that you just want to know a little bit more. What's the next line? What's she going to say? What's she trying to tell us? I mean, it's really remarkable. And it's not, it's not a million miles away, is it, from some of the music of Stephen Sondheim? It's just before, you know, the style of Sondheim that we got used to knowing, you know, the articulate side of it. But it's quite extraordinary. I mean, he had this ability. He does it in his concert music as well. I mean, his symphonies and Chichester Psalms, you know, a great piece for choir, where it's terribly simple and you just get drawn into this thing. And you're right. I mean, he has these myriad of styles. But I think, you know, that's probably... I mean, he's probably as hugely influential and as unique as a composer as Gershwin was, you know, for the world, not just for America. I mean, hugely important for America, but for the world.
And you mentioned there the symphonies and Chichester Psalms. I think one could argue that, in fact, Bernstein had a broader reach, if you like, than Gershwin. And Gershwin, that kind of crossover between jazz and classical, but Bernstein went further along the route, I think, in those terms. But talk to me a little bit about conducting those various styles. I mean, because you have the overture to Candide, for example, at the concert on Wednesday week. You have pieces from America and some of the pieces that we've just, or from West Side Story rather, and some of the pieces that we've just heard that involve vocalists. We'll have Sophie Evans, Caroline Sheen, Rob Houchin and Damien Humbley on the night. Is it very different to conduct the big orchestral sections and then the vocal works? Is that a very different style of conducting, or how do you go about that?
Well, it's a completely different approach to each one because it's so much a partnership between, you know, three of us or more, if there's more singers. I mean, so a singer and myself and the orchestra, whereas the concert pieces are a partnership between myself and the orchestra. I mean, I'm one of those conductors who believes passionately that the orchestra has a huge contribution even without me. You know, it's making music together. And so I think when we have a soloist involved and then, so a duet and then a trio and a quartet, you know, it becomes much more complicated because everybody should, rightly so, have an involvement in this. And an invested involvement, so it does become different. And there are things like that. You know, you mentioned the overture to Candide. This is one of the great show pieces of all, you know, 20th century music. I mean, it's fantastic. The orchestra have a riot. The audiences love it, and it's just the most wonderful, uplifting piece of music. As is Mambo, but its Mambo is a completely different, you know, rhythmic structure, isn't it? But it is very different from every single aspect. And he doesn't give you lots of help because his styles are so various and varied, so that, you know, orchestrally you go from one style to another style.
And do you think, as he composed, that he, that Leonard Bernstein, composer, either had Leonard Bernstein, conductor, or indeed possibly a pupil of his, Andre Previn, and a pupil of his, Martin Yeats, if Andre Previn's that is, that he had other conductors in mind? Or did he, you know, sometimes playwrights who are actors write for themselves, if you know what I mean. Did he compose for himself?
I think he did compose for himself. And I think, you know, he just had this natural facility. You know, you look at any of his handwritten scores and they are written at huge speed. You can see that. He just put down on paper what he absolutely knew was right for him. And I don't think he probably thought much about how it was going to work out to be conducted. Some of his music is very complex.
Yeah.
But, you know, he had such a technique as a conductor. I don't think it probably ever worried him, but it worries everybody else, you know, that follows.
Yeah, well, if you learned how to have one rhythm on your left hand and something else on your right hand when you were a kid, I suppose doing it as a conductor comes second nature when you're an adult.
Yeah.
What about that lineage, just that, before we finish up with the final piece, Martin, that lineage that I've mentioned from Bernstein to Andre Previn to yourself, because Previn was your teacher, Bernstein was his. Do you have a sense of something coming down through Previn to you from Bernstein?
I certainly have a sense of what Andre imbued in any of his students, which was an amazing freedom, an amazing sort of, want to let the orchestra play and to encourage them in such a way so that they do play. And Bernstein was exactly the same. You know, I mean, of course, he imposed many things. And I'm sure there are some performances we would listen to of his Mahler where some people would say, wow, God, that's a bit over the top. Mm. Because things are different now, you know, in 2024. We look at things differently. But he wore his heart on his sleeve. You know, he was a conductor who at the time when he started conducting Mahler, not so many people were doing it. And he really brought it to the fore. And he brought his own vision of it. You know, I just think that there is what's wonderful about a heritage is, you know, here was two, I consider, great conductors, very different men, but Bernstein and Previn, you know, absolute, you know, geniuses of what they did. Their abilities were incredible, and when you look at them, it's always very hard for any of us to measure up anywhere near to them. You know,
did the film Maestro come anywhere near explaining to you the great conductor and composer that Bernstein was?
No, not really, because I think they had other issues to show us, which was, you know, the side of his life that was sort of inner turmoil, if you like. But I think it's almost impossible to without being putting it under a microscope, putting him under a microscope musically, and that's not going to be interesting to a lot of people. You know, I think what interests people is that they hear the music and it's amazing. I don't think they necessarily need to know what Bernstein had for lunch that day. You know?
Well, we don't know what he had when he was composing West Side Story, but whatever it was, when he came to composing America, it was must have had a little bit of Puerto Rican spice in there somewhere. How would you set us off into America from West Side Story, Martin?
Well, I think, you know, you've just hit it on the head. I mean, he absolutely captured it says tempo de huapango, which is a dance, you know, which the way you say it tells you how the piece is going to go.
Well, it's a tempo de huapango after a nice sultry description of Puerto Rico. Martin, looking forward to seeing you next week. And thanks so much for being with us this evening. That's Martin Yeats, who will be conducting the RTE Concert Orchestra on Wednesday week in many Bernstein places, including this one.
Puerto Rico, my heart's devotion, let it sink back in the ocean. Always the hurricanes blowing, always the population growing. The sunlight streaming and the natives steaming. I like the island Manhattan.
I know you do.
Smoke on your pipe and put it in.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America.
For a small fee in America.
Okay.
Freddy be so nice.
One look at us and they charge twice.
I have my own washing machine.
What will you have though to keep clean?
Skyscrapers bloom in America. Cadillac bloom in America. Industry boom in America.
12 in a room in America.
Lots of new housing with more space.
Lots of doors slamming in our face.
I'll get a terrace apartment.
Better get rid of your accent.
Life can be bright in America.
If you can fight in America.
Life is all right in America.
If you're all white in America.
And there they go. Wapangoing off across the room, if that is the verb for dancing such a dance. America from West Side Story. The original film soundtrack was what we were listening to there. Rita Moreno and George Takeiris among the voices that we heard. And it was Bernstein himself conducting that original score. The event that we were talking about, Martin Yusp, about Leonard Bernstein, a celebration, takes place at the National Concert Hall, 8 p.m. Wednesday week, the 9th of October. And full information on rte.ie/co. Kris Kristofferson, the actor, songwriter and country music singer, has died at the age of 88. He's best known perhaps for his songs Sunday Morning Coming Down and Help Me Make It Through the Night and For the Good Times. He went on to win 3 Grammys and was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. He later formed the supergroup The Highwaymen with Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson. What a supergroup that was. Kristofferson also had a successful career as an actor, achieved a global stardom and a Golden Globe for his role as John Norman Howard opposite Barbara Streisand, who we heard from earlier on, of course, and that was in the film A Star Is Born. He also served in Martin Scorsese's Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore with Ellen Burstyn and as the sheriff in Michael Cimino's controversial western Heaven's Gate. Let's listen to Kristofferson, a little bit of one of his most famous songs. It was a huge posthumous hit for Janis Joplin, but here it is sung by the late Kris Kristofferson, me and Bobby McGee.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge and heading for the trains, feeling nearly fading as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained. Took us all away to New Orleans. I took my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana that was blowing sad while Bobby sang the blues. With them windshield wipers slapping time out, Bobby clapping hands, we finally sang a bell of song that driver knew, didn't we, Cook? Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and Bobby McGee.
The wonderful Kris Kristofferson there and his even more wonderful lived-in voice. His death, of course, was announced today. He died at the age of 88. Rarely do films and the political context from which they come have such a relevance and emotional punch as Farah Nabulsi's The Teacher. Set in the occupied West Bank, The Teacher is the story of a former freedom fighter turned school teacher, Bassem. He wants to stop his students taking revenge for the terrible cruelties that are inflicted on them and their families by neighbouring Israeli settlers. If we needed more current reference to the situation in Gaza, we also have a Jewish couple looking for their son who has been taken captive by Palestinian militants. I'm delighted to be joined on the line this evening by The Teacher's writer and director, Farah Nabulsi. Lovely to have you with us this evening, Farah, and thanks for joining us. We hear a lot very early on in this film, a conversation between the teacher, this Bassem character that I've spoken about, and his two students, two brothers, Adam and Jakob. They're sitting on a sofa set in front of the bulldozed rubble of the brothers' family home. That is quite an image when you see them sitting there with this. We see it actually being demolished behind their backs, their family home. You filmed in the occupied West Bank, I presume, or did you see such things happening even as you were filming there?
Hi. Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, while we did sort of reenact that kind of devastating injustice that these boys experience, it's something that I've personally not just witnessed, but have spent a lot of time with Palestinians on the ground in Palestine, whose homes have been demolished. And then strangely enough, while we were shooting that scene, or, you know, during the shoot, on my way to work, actually, one of the days, I passed by a house and there was a couple with their six children standing on the side of the road in front of the rubble of their freshly demolished home. So it's happening every day. It's a process. It's a systematic process that takes place by the Israeli military, unfortunately.
Yeah, and you've seen this at. You witnessed it yourself at first hand. But the story that you're telling here, while it starts from a point of historical truth, or certainly has echoes of an historical situation, it is a fiction. But maybe talk to us a little bit about the real life event, the real life hostage event that set this story off in your mind.
Mm-mm. Well, so yeah, you know, I came across this story of an Israeli occupation soldier called Gilad Shalit, who in 2006 was abducted, was captured, and in 2011 he was released for over 1,000 Palestinian political prisoners, hundreds of whom were women and children, hundreds of whom had been held in administrative detention, which means without trial or charge. And at the time, I just thought this was an insane imbalance in value for human life. But, you know, honestly, I could never have imagined that this film would have arrived at a time when that imbalance in value for human life would be so exponentially magnified with the, you know, ongoing current genocide in Gaza, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are being killed, maimed, burned, blinded, or buried under the rubble, dead and alive, and over nearly 2 million have been displaced from their homes and their lives and their livelihoods. So actually, this imbalance in value for human life that I first kind of was shocked by is just completely overshadowed now with this lack of any value for Palestinian human life, it seems, at this moment in time.
The story that you tell then, it has quite a layered story, and it's seen from many different viewpoints. But essentially, I suppose, in many ways, the person I found myself following and whom I was most interested in some ways is this young boy, this young man, Adam, whose brother is killed in front of his eyes for no good reason at all by an Israeli settler.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think people don't realize that this Israeli vandalism and violence that comes from these illegal settlers, but is essentially aided and abetted by the Israeli military and the Israeli authorities, is something that's been going on for decades. And it was in an all-time high just prior to October 7th. And since then, it's expanded exponentially. And so these Palestinian young men, youth, farmers, people on their land, are harassed and terrorized by these settlers every other day. And there's numerous, thousands of stories I could tell you. Mm. And this is just the one. But the question becomes, you know, what is the reaction? What is the recourse for justice when, you know, someone you love is killed? And of course, we've all been teenagers, right? And you know, the question becomes, does one seek or feel like they need revenge or some kind of justice? And that's what the film kind of, you know,
focuses in on. Yeah. And, this idea of the teacher played by Salah Bakri, who is trying to impart to that young character of Adam, well, perhaps, you know, the quick lashback isn't the way to do this. Have a think about what you want to do and think it through carefully. But another very interesting line that you take is we do see the parents of the fictional hostage in this case. We see his parents searching for him. And it's a clip that I want to listen to, which has Stanley Townsend Townsend as this is really Father, coming to Salah Bakri's character, the Bassem, the teacher character of the film's title, and talking about what it is he has a feeling that this teacher is involved in the hostage holding.
My wife, she blames me. First, I didn't take a stand to stop them for not doing enough to get him back. But I don't know what to do. So I am here asking you if you know anything. Please.
I don't know where your son is, and I can't help him anyway. This is what I told your people when they came into my home. Twice.
They're not my people. I know what happened to your own son. I don't know whether you know where Nathaniel is, and I shouldn't expect you to help even if you did. But for what it's worth, as a father, I am truly, truly sorry for your loss.
They'll keep him alive as long as it takes.
How do you know that?
Because they know that your people believe your son is worth thousands of mine.
And that's Salah Bakri playing the character of Bassem al-Salah. And we also heard Stanley Townsend there as the character of Simon Cohen in the film The Teacher. And the film's writer and director, Farhad Nabulsi, is with me on the programme this evening. It is such a powerful scene because we see the humanity of the two men involved there. And this theme of fatherhood is very important, I think, within the film itself, Farah.
Absolutely. I mean, this film for me really is about the love of a parent. And the love a parent has for their child, as well as the pursuit of justice, those two elements. What is interesting, though, is that there's two parallels, you know, the parallel between the fathers, but they're also opposite and completely divergent as well, because one has a recourse to justice and the other doesn't. And sadly, that's the case for Palestinians, you know, no matter how big the crime or how massive the loss. The people that they need to turn to for justice are one and the same as those complicit in the crime. You know, that the system is perverted. It's a bit of a joke. So it's an interesting dynamic that I wanted to explore.
That experience of filming in the occupied West Bank, I can't imagine how difficult that was because of the subject matter of the film as well.
Overwhelming, because making independent cinema anyway is absolutely exhausting and overwhelming and difficult. And then now you've got military occupation and colonization and apartheid to deal with that's unfolding around you in real time. So it was very overwhelming emotionally, mentally, physically, logistically, and all of it. And as I said, I mean, there's, like you said, there's a scene where these settlers are burning the olive groves. And that's something was taking place as well in real time. We got word while we were shooting that was happening in the nearby village of Barine, where the teacher is actually from in the film. Yeah. So it was really upside down for us and really quite overwhelming. But we got there in the end, you know?
Yeah, and the burning of an olive tree, of course, so symbolic in and of itself. But Farah, thank you so much for joining us this evening. That's Farah Nabulsi, writer and director of The Teacher, which is released in Irish cinemas. It's in selected cinemas, including The Lighthouse at the moment. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.